Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FSCOM's latest webinar on safeguarding 1 year on from attestation exercise. So, my name is Elaine Tyne. I'm the marketing manager in FSCOM and organizer of today's webinar. So just to start off with the usual housekeeping, if you have any technical difficulties with audio or viewing the webinar, please refer to the confirmation email for answers to any connection problems. And look, if you're still having any issues, feel free to message us in the chat area or email the team at marketing@fscom.co.uk. So just a reminder, you have joined the webinar in listen-only mode, which means you are muted on entry, but we would encourage everyone, please use this opportunity to ask as many questions via the chat form at the side, and we'll endeavour to answer them in the panel session later. If we can't answer the questions, all of the questions today, we will come back to you individually after the webinar. So look, finally, the recording will be made available after this session. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce the presenters for this afternoon session. So Colin Sloan, who's Senior Manager in the Payments Team in FSCOM, Alison Donnelly, who's Director, and Rachel Stevenson, who is Senior Manager also in the Payments Team. And the format is Colin is going to start off and deliver the presentation for the first half hour, and then we'll move on to the panel session where he'll be joined by Alison Donnelly, and Rachel Stevenson will then pose the questions to the panel. So look, without further ado, we are all going to hide our cameras and let Colin start with the first part of it. So good afternoon, Colin.
Thanks, Elaine. Great to have you with us today. So we're going to be looking today at safeguarding under the e-money regulations and the payment services regulations. So really a hot button topic at the moment and an area of intensified FCA focus. So really what I want to do, first of all, is cover, sort of basically provide an overview of the safeguarding requirement. And then I kind of look at where we are at the moment in terms of safeguarding. So I think a key event in terms of the SA supervision of safeguarding was last year in 2019 with their thematic review, and then the Dear CEO letter and attestation process in July 2019. And so I want to look at where we are 1 year on from that. And then just before the panel, I want to finish with a few key takeaways, which I consider to be the most important points for firms to consider. So first of all, an introduction to safeguarding. So I would consider it to be the chief area of consumer protection within the payment and e-money regulations. And it's an area of intensified focus from the FCA. So like I said, you had a thematic review of 11 PSPs followed by a Dear CEO letter that went out to all payment and e-money institutions in July 2019. And they had to return a letter confirming either their compliance or non-compliance with the requirement. And they had to do it very quickly, within a few weeks. And following that attestation process, indeed, the FCA continued scrutinising firms' compliance and contacting firms in relation to the safeguarding compliance. And we at FSCOM certainly saw that throughout the last year in assisting our clients with safeguarding. So where are we now? Well, in May, just past, the FCA have issued a consultation on additional proposed guidance on safeguarding. And they've really done that in light of the coronavirus pandemic and really wanting to make sure that customer funds are adequately protected. But first of all, what is safeguarding? Well, safeguarding basically describes the process that firms need to undertake in relation to relevant funds. So what are relevant funds? Well, for a payment institution, relevant funds are funds received in order to make a payment on behalf of their client. And then for e-money institutions, relevant funds are funds received in exchange for e-money issued. And of course, relevant funds can also be received by firms through branches, agents, or in the case of e-money institutions, distributors. Interestingly, e-money institutions, where they receive funds in relation funds via a payment instrument, may in certain circumstances have up to 5 days to safeguard those funds. But we will look at that shortly. So how do you do it? So we've looked at what are the funds that need to be protected. How do you in fact protect those funds? Well, the regulations give you a couple of options. First of all, you can use the segregation method, which is the method used by the vast majority of firms to safeguard relevant funds. Second option, which is far less common, is insurance, though it is sort of creeping up. More firms are using insurance, if not for the entire process, maybe for a portion of it where segregation is a bit messy. Segregation, if you are segregating customer funds, that obligation begins at receipt of the funds. And then the regulations say that if you still retain those funds at the end of the business day following the receipt of those funds, you have to place them in a specific designated account with an EEA credit institution. And that account has to have several conditions attached to it to satisfy the regulations. So a safeguarding account, what has to be in the safeguarding account? Well, first thing, I mean, this is really a perennial issue that we face, particularly when advising prospective applicants to the FCA. The first issue firms face is actually acquiring those accounts, because due to de-risking, and indeed, we just saw a couple of weeks ago BFC offload a number of payment institutions. Due to de-risking, firms can find it very difficult to get these accounts. But the accounts must meet the following conditions. One, they have to be held with an authorised EEA credit institution or the Bank of England. Now, interestingly, following the end of the transition period, from January 2021 onwards, you will be able to safeguard at a credit institution at an OECD country. So the sort of scope there is going to be broadened beyond Europe. But for the moment, it's an EEA credit institution. The account must be named to indicate that it's for safeguarding purposes. It must only be used for relevant funds. In other words, can't use it for taking customer funds, but also for paying your suppliers. And no other person other than the payment or e-money institution must have any right over those funds. So essentially, in the worst case scenario, you're in administration, those funds are protected from your creditors. So that's sort of what the account looks like and kind of what relevant funds are. But when does the obligation actually end? And that question is probably one of the more controversial or disputed questions in safeguarding. So the general principle is that the obligation ends when the funds are no longer held with the PSP. But then the question is, well, when are the funds no longer held with the PSP? And with international payments, that becomes more complicated, because sometimes firms have intermediary payment service providers that they use in order to move the funds to the ultimate beneficiary. And really, I think I would argue, on the basis of the FCA guidance, the funds only cease to become relevant when they're transferred to another PSP that's actually not contracted with you as the payment or e-money institution, but contracted with the payee. So just a couple of scenarios just to get you thinking. So I'm going to read the scenario in a second, give you half a minute to sort of think through it, and then I'll walk you through it. But Scenario one, ABC Limited, ABC, is a payment institution that offers foreign exchange and payment services via its online platform. ABC's client contracts with a Chinese exporter to purchase goods to sell in the UK. Following the FX transaction, ABC sends the converted currency to an account it holds with a bank in Hong Kong, and from there settles to the payee's account in mainland China. At what point do those funds cease to be relevant? Is it one, following the completion of the FX transaction? Two, when the goods arrive in the UK? Three, when the funds arrive in Hong Kong? Or four, when the funds are paid from Hong Kong to the payee's account in mainland China? So I'll just give you 30 seconds to have a wee think about that. So, hope you had a chance to think through that one. So, the answer is actually four, when the funds are paid from Hong Kong to the payee's account in mainland China. And the reason really is that the bank in Hong Kong is contracted with ABC. Bank in Hong Kong is not contracted with the Chinese exporter, who's the payee. And so the funds, from ABC's perspective, continue to be relevant until the payee that's contracted with it has paid the funds actually to the payee's PSP. So that's scenario one. And we'll look at one more. As of scenario two, DEF Limited, DEF, is an e-money institution that provides prepaid cards sold at retail outlets. The retail outlets serve as distributors, loading the e-money onto the cards in exchange for customer funds. At the end of the working week, the retailers send the aggregate amount of customer funds to DEF's safeguarding account. But when in fact should the funds be safeguarded? Is it one, when the prepaid cards are manufactured? Two, when the funds are received by the distributors? Three, at the end of the business day following receipt by the distributor? Or four, when they arrive at a DEF designated account? So I'll just again give you 30 seconds to have a think through that one. Great. So the answer here is two, when the funds are received by the distributors. So basically under the regulations, the payment or e-money institution is responsible for any act or omission on the part of the agent or the distributor. So in the case of DEF, the distributor is receiving the funds on behalf of DEF. And actually the safeguarding obligation will commence when the distributor receives the funds. And according to the regulations at that point, the funds should be segregated upon receipt. Great, so we've kind of given a brief overview of the requirement, but obviously, you know, things change, the FCA supervisory approach develops over time, the interpretive guidance develops over time. I think we saw that with the attestation process, that their letter around the thematic review really kind of revealed some developments in their interpretive guidance. And now, 1 year on, the FCA have actually published an additional consultation for additional guidance. I mean, in terms of what we learned from the thematic review, I think it's just useful quickly to point out really at several deficiencies across the industry that the FCA noted from that review. So really their concerns were as follows. One, a lack of clarity on relevant and non-relevant funds. So firms hadn't really laid out fully and in an organized manner their fund flows and sort of identified when the funds are relevant, when they're not relevant, what needs to be swept out, etc. Firms had not documented sufficiently the safeguarding and the reconciliation process. Lack of segregation and infrequent removal of non-relevant funds from the safeguarding account. Funds not segregated at agents or distributors, so agents and distributors kind of left to do their own thing. Safeguarding accounts not being appropriately designated. Some firms actually not undertaking internal reconciliation. So the FCA have made a distinction in the approach document between internal reconciliation and external reconciliation. And then also poor governance. So insufficient oversight from the board or the risk committee in terms of the safeguarding process, and it instead really being dealt with on an exceptions basis. So that was really their concerns last year. What is the additional guidance that they've consulted on? Well, we'll look at this piece by piece. So first of all, reconciliation. The FCA have clarified that they expect firms to have a documented reconciliation procedure. So many of the firms that we've reviewed in terms of safeguarding in the last year, the vast majority will have carried out some form of reconciliation procedure, but many firms actually have not documented that procedure. So the FCA have clarified crystal clear that should be done. Records of the reconciliation should be retained in order, in the worst case scenario, to assist the insolvency practitioner to distribute the funds to the clients. And the FCA have also clarified they expect to be notified, A, where the firm has not kept up-to-date records, and two, when the credit institution decides to close the safeguarding account, which is obviously relevant for a number of firms following BFC's withdrawal from the market. They've also made some proposed guidance on the whole issue of safeguarding accounts. So first of all, in terms of how those accounts are designated, they've said explicitly that the account should contain the name, either safeguarding or client. And if it's not possible for those names to be included, the firm should obtain a letter from the credit institution detailing that the specific accounts are safeguarding accounts under the regulations. Now, many firms will already have letters in place. But I think where the guidance differs is the FCA are now proposing to require firms to send a specific template letter to their credit institution for signature. And that template letter depicts the firm as a trustee of client funds. So this is an issue that some industry bodies and some firms have pushed back on, because the regulations themselves do not use the word trustee in terms of the firm's role in safeguarding. And there could be significant legal implications if that is in fact the case, not least the fact that firms may need to consider amending their terms and conditions if it is indeed the case that they are performing a trustee function in relation to the funds. So really significant developments there for firms that may as a result actually need to be contacting their credit institutions. Reviewing safeguarding accounts, and in a way this is a little bit, it might not really even be seen as applicable by many firms, because beggars can't be choosers after all. It's the firm that needs the safeguarding account. There aren't a lot of providers out there, but nonetheless, the FCA have clarified they expect firms to exercise due skill, care and diligence in selecting safeguarding providers. And so really, if you're not doing it already, you really need to in place a process of at least annual due diligence reviews of your safeguarding provider. And the SCA approach document lays out a number of criteria you can use to perform that assessment. For example, the credit rating of the banking provider. So it's really important to document that process. Card transactions, and this is specifically in relation to e-money institutions. So where an e-money institution enables its customers to load funds onto their e-money account via card payment, it usually takes a day or two for the firm's merchant acquirer to settle the funds to the e-money institution. However, as we know, the e-money institution will issue the e-money immediately, enabling the customer to redeem that e-money and purchase and basically use the account to make purchases. Now, the issue with that, obviously, is the funds haven't arrived. And so firms could be in danger of using other customer funds to facilitate those transactions. And what the FCA have said is that the firm cannot use other customer funds to facilitate those transactions. And so in reality, if the e-money institution is to enable customers that have loaded funds via card payment to make payment transactions from the e-money account, they're really going to need to consider topping up the safeguarding account in the interim, because the SCA are clarifying here it's not permissible to use other customer funds to facilitate those payment transactions. Obviously, the e-money regulations say that where a customer has loaded loaded value onto the e-money account via a payment institution, the e-money institution must safeguard the funds either when they're credited to the payment account, made available, or at the latest within 5 business days. But in reality, certainly my interpretation would be that the funds are made available to the e-money institution when the payment transaction is approved, when the card transaction is approved by its merchant acquirer. So you can still issue the e-money to the customer, but you need, following the FCA's guidance, you will need to consider topping up that safeguarding account with your own funds in the interim. Unallocated funds. So this is again another common issue. So many firms receive funds where incorrect information has been entered on the payment, and so they're actually not able to allocate those funds to an individual customer. And so the question is, what do you do with those funds? And the SCA have clarified, quite surprisingly in my view, that in that instance, those funds should not be safeguarded with other relevant funds. And in fact, they've gone further and said those funds should be segregated separately, which I found surprising because the funds are, for all intents and purposes, well, in all likelihood, they will have been sent to the firm for the purpose of a payment transaction or for the purpose of issuing e-money. And so I would have expected the FCA to have wanted those funds to be safeguarded, but they've now clarified that that's not the case. Now, the issue for firms from this is you will need to consider, if this guidance is finalised, possibly opening up a third set of accounts to actually segregate unallocated funds, which again could cause a number of headaches for firms with their credit institutions. Annual audit. Following the attestation exercise last year, FSCOM have done multiple safeguarding audits of firms, and those firms are really doing it for best practice reasons, wanting to make sure that their house is in order. But in actual fact, it was never a legal requirement or a regulatory requirement. Now the FCA are clarifying that they expect firms that require an annual financial audit to also obtain an annual audit of their safeguarding requirements. Now, many firms fall under the small business audit exemption and so won't be required to do this. However, interestingly, under the Companies Act 2006, all e-money institutions are exempt from the small business exemption for audits. And so all e-money institutions, if this guidance is finalised, will be required to obtain an annual audit of their safeguarding requirements. The FCA have also said that firms should obtain a safeguarding audit where there are any changes to the business model, which would materially affect their safeguarding arrangements. So if you're launching a new product or if the fund flow is changing, might be time to consider a safeguarding audit. And then finally, they're saying that, I think as par for the course, firms should exercise due diligence in making that decision. And then disclosure of information. Again, not really much new news here, but firms should be very clear in terms of customer communication. So in particular, beware of using FSCS in relation to e-money or payment services. That's a real bugbear for the FCA. So kind of, I hope that's given a sort of brief synopsis of the additional guidance. But let me just, again, just quickly summarise what I consider the key takeaways from the consultation to be. One, have you drawn out your fund flows and noted where the safeguarding obligation starts and ends? If I was starting anywhere on this, it would be the fund flows, because I think all of the other obligations flow from that. Two, is your safeguarding and reconciliation process adequately documented? Particularly the reconciliation procedure. You don't want to be in a position where your reconciliation procedure is sort of all in the heads of a couple of folks in the finance team. Three, do you perform your reconciliation as often as practicable? Four, have you a separate set of accounts for unallocated funds? Unfortunately, if this guidance is finalised, that seems to be what the FCA is pushing for. And finally, are you required to have a safeguarding audit? Something to think about there. But look, I think that's me, so I'll be quiet and we can move on to our Q&A.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks for that really clear and comprehensive overview. As Elaine mentioned at the top of the call, we've got some time set aside for the panel discussion, and I get the really easy job today of putting the tricky questions to both Dee and Alison. But we've had a couple of questions come through. So Alison, I'll pick on you first. Colin mentioned the consultation, and one of our attendees has asked, when do we expect the FCA to respond to this consultation? Do we have any idea of timeline?
Thanks, Rachel. So I think if everything had gone according to plan, I'm pretty sure the FCA would have expected to have published their consultation, their finalised guidance already, because, I mean, the whole point of having the temporary guidance is because it's an emergency situation. It was a very short consultation. They obviously thought it was worth putting it out very quickly. So I think they probably had hoped to have it out already. That being said, I think they were maybe somewhat surprised by some of the feedback that they received, perhaps particularly around the issue of the inclusion of the word trust account and trustee in the letter that they were asking firms to get their safeguarding account provider to sign. I don't think that they anticipated quite the concern that was caused by that. And there were other issues that were highlighted in the consultation as well. So I think they've taken some time to review that, which is good and important. But I would expect that they will be turning out the finalised guidance as soon as they can, maybe in the next couple of weeks, I believe.
Very good. That actually relates to another question that we've got through. So do we think that finding a safeguarding provider is going to be even more difficult now that the FCA are specifying this template letter?
Well, that was certainly the concern put to the FCA in the consultation process. What firms were saying very loud and clear through the trade associations and individually is that the inclusion of the trust reference was not expected. It was not understood that that's what was being created. There's and we don't understand what the implications of that will be. I think there's very genuine and very deep concern at anything that makes banks feel that it's more complicated to provide safeguarding accounts to the sector. And so, you know, if that's another thing that could be added to the complications, then there's a potential that yes, the banks will de-risk. I think part of the concern has been that that banks might see that if this is regarded as a trust relationship, that they need to understand who the beneficiaries are in greater depth than they do at present. And so they would want to know who the underlying customers are and be able to access that information. So it's almost like there's additional obligations that would be tied in with providing the safeguarding account. Either that becomes too tricky to do or it becomes too expensive to do. And either way, it might result in firms just withdrawing from the sector.
Thanks very much, Alison. Okay, Colin, I'll pick on you next. This is quite a common question. We get this quite often, but can you tell me what the difference is between an internal and an external reconciliation?
Sure, yes. So this is a very common question and many firms really only seem to do the external reconciliation. The FCA specified in 10.59 of the approach document that you should really do both. So an internal reconciliation is really the process of how you know what amount of relevant funds should be safeguarded. So if you think about an e-money institution, the firm receives relevant funds in exchange for e-money that's issued. That e-money that is issued is really a debt that the firm owes to its customers. And that debt obviously should be recorded in the firm's books. But the relevant funds that are received are a credit. Those are funds that are owned by the firm. And so the firm essentially should have an internal record of those debits and credits. Now, in terms of the firm knowing what are the correct amount of relevant funds that should be safeguarded, really an internal reconciliation involves a comparison between the aggregate amount of e-money issued, or in the case of a payment institution, say the funds that are owed to customers that are being held on a payment account, but an aggregate amount of funds held on the customer's account versus the aggregate of the funds, relevant funds that are held in the safeguarding account, but not the aggregate amount from the external record held at the safeguarding provider, the aggregate amount from the firm's internal records. So it's really the internal reconciliation then compares those two internal records to figure out what are how much relevant funds should be safeguarded. Then once you've done that, the external reconciliation involves a comparison between the amount that should be safeguarded and actually how much is actually in the safeguarding account, how much is actually held there. And that data is pulled from the safeguarding provider. So internal reconciliation, two internal records of debit and credit, external reconciliation, how much should be safeguarded versus how much actually is being safeguarded.
Great. So what you're saying is
Sorry, don't jump in. I was just going to say that I think some firms find a difficulty in our experience. I mean, we've been talking to many firms over many years about safeguarding, and I think some firms find it difficult to draw information from some safeguarding providers that's timely in or, you know, because this is going to be a snapshot in time. And so it's getting the confirmation of the funds at the point when you're doing the reconciliation can prove problematic.
Brilliant. Thank you both. A colleague of ours once said very, very succinctly that in order to complete the internal reconciliation, you shouldn't even be looking at your bank statement yet. And I think that can come as a shock whenever our clients are thinking about the reconciliation, that actually the internal piece, you shouldn't even be looking at your bank statements at that stage, which I think, you know, there's a tendency, as you mentioned, to see it all as one reconciliation procedure.
And that's a repeated conversation. Sorry, go on, Alison.
The other thing that I think where firms get a bit confused is between segregating the funds and the reconciliation. Now, the reconciliation might identify where further funds need to be segregated, but the segregation obligation is relevant right from receipt of funds. So that should be happening throughout. It's not a thing that you just do because you've just done your reconciliation.
Absolutely.
On that point, Alison, here's another question for you. Is it acceptable to move funds out of the safeguarding account on the day the payment is made?
So obviously there's no problem with sending the funds from the safeguarding account when it's going directly to the recipients. I think there's perhaps what the question is really pointing to is whether there's any problem in withdrawing the funds from the safeguarding account, letting them sit in another account before they're transferred to the recipient, or if they're transferred to another payment institution, for instance, another in the chain. And that's where the problems arise, because once the requirement passes, so we've talked about the segregation, going back to Colin's diagram earlier, you've got the segregation from point of receipt. By the end of the business day following the day of receipt, that's when they're to be in the special safeguarding account. They shouldn't be leaving that account until they are paid out to the beneficiary, not to somebody else in the chain, but to the beneficiary. And you know, again, this causes problems for many firms. Either they haven't understood that that's the expectation, or they just simply don't have the capital available, because it's quite possible then that you're going to have to duplicate the funds, because there needs to be funds sitting in the safeguarding account, plus also funds that are being transferred to the payment institution. Or if for some other reason you need to pull them out of the safeguarding account, perhaps for liquidity for the FX, that's not good enough. That's not, you know, we know that that is not acceptable to the FCA. And it's actually something that, you know, I've said to the FCA that they need to make sure that they communicate that expectation very clearly, because what we have at the moment is a situation where some firms know that because they've received the advice and guidance specifically and directly from the FCA. Others know it because we've told them, but I think there's a whole raft of firms out there who are not fully clear on that point. And it's a really important point.
Brilliant, thank you. I can see that we've got quite a few questions in about Wirecard and how they've been safeguarding customer funds given the recent news. It may be a bit too soon to comment because we don't have any concrete information as yet, but do either of you feel like you can comment on that at this stage?
I think it's difficult to comment on the Wirecard case in particular, because we simply don't have the facts. You know, there may well be a lot of things happening that behind the scenes and we're not aware of. What we do know, of course, is just that this is a kind of situation where people are concerned about their funds. And I think the Wirecard situation in particular has highlighted just how many vulnerable customers are relying on e-money accounts. You know, I think there's been numbers bandied around in terms of thousands and thousands of people who were not able to access their funds on a Friday of going into a weekend, a day of a payday. And so they weren't able to receive their funds and they weren't able to spend their funds. And that can leave them in a very tricky situation. So it goes to show the importance of some, it's not the whole sector. You know, there's many e-money and payment institutions that are not primary accounts for customers, but there is a sector of the community who are using e-money accounts, and that they've been led to do that. They're led to do that because it's easier to get an account, because these providers are directly targeting and facilitating and making it better and easier and to have an account, and that's good. That's a financial inclusion tactic that we're all supportive of. So they're meeting a need and they're doing it in the right way. But when it comes to difficulties, any kind of difficulty, whether it's going into administration or it's some other kind of difficulty, those people are the ones that are left without their funds at a very vulnerable time. And so I think whilst we can't comment on the detail of what's happened with Wirecard, clearly there will be it will be important for the sector to look at what's happened and to learn the lessons, and that includes the FCA as well as government and the sector itself.
Absolutely. I suppose the other thing to say is that any kind of case that arises and where whether customer funds are frozen or other firms that go into administration, it kind of the debate about FSCS versus safeguarding always raises its head. And I suppose it's just another reminder that with safeguarding, ultimately at the end of the day, the customer is reliant on the firm having got the process right.
You're absolutely right, Colin. The safeguarding process could be in some ways regarded as better than FSCS cover, because if you happen to have more than £85,000 in an account, technically that whole amount of money is safeguarded. That's what it should be. So the FSCS threshold just doesn't apply, it doesn't matter. But at the same time, if either your safeguarding provider goes bust or the firm itself goes bust, there's no FSCS cover, so there's no fallback situation that can cover it. And it's something that I've raised with the FCA a number of times, including just as recently as on Friday, to say this is an option that needs to be properly explored. I don't think it's ever really had the airtime and analysis that it deserves. And I think more and more as we see in the sector grow, it's time to really put some thought to it. It's not good enough to just hold off for another crisis and another something to go wrong. Let's look at it now. Again, pointing to the fact that there is a wealth, a number of firms directly targeting those who are perhaps more vulnerable in our society, and we need to make sure that their rights are protected.
Brilliant. Thank you both. Okay, let's see. We have another question in about the safeguarding insurance that you mentioned, Colin. Would you recommend safeguarding insurance as an alternative to the segregation method?
Well, I've worked with a number of clients that have benefited from it. I suppose from what I understand, it is very expensive. Speaking to one insurer, the insurer that I was speaking to kind of even said himself that the product is more suited to part of the process rather than the whole process. So, for example, where it's worked well for clients is in relation to where intermediary PSPs are used. So where in those cases where the provider isn't making a direct payment from the safeguarding account to the payee, well, they still need to safeguard those funds that are with the intermediary. So it's actually worked well for some firms to take out insurance for that bit of process. So absolutely, I think it's a bit tidier than sort of some of the, trying to make sure that everything is sometimes safeguarded through the segregation method, but probably not for your entire process. And the other thing is, of course, that even with the insurance method, you still need a safeguarding account, because the proceeds of the insurance policy have to go into the safeguarding account.
Great. It does seem to, it was sort of hailed as a silver bullet solution. You get the insurance and you no longer need to worry about your procedures and your reconciliations, but actually you still need to do all that. It's just a, it's just replacing that, that segregation in the bank account piece.
Absolutely.
And when you mentioned the cost, Colin, I think that's a really important point. I think firms are having to weigh up whether it's the cost of the loss of opportunity to use that fund, those funds elsewhere, is the because it's switching out the duplication of the funds with paying for the insurance guarantee that allows them to use that money elsewhere, which might be a good solution for them.
Great. I think we have time for one more question. Alison, should funds for which a suspicious activity report, where you've got funds, should funds for which a suspicious activity report has been submitted to the National Crime Agency be safeguarded?
Well, that's a good question. So there's, yes, because we know that those funds have been provided for the purposes of making a payment. When you submit a suspicious activity report, it's just a suspicion at that stage. It's not concrete evidence, and therefore I think it's appropriate to hold the funds to the proper level of security and safety in the safeguarding account as you would with the other funds. So the answer to that one is yes.
Great. And the key is document that rationale in your safeguarding policy.
Absolutely. Have we mentioned the safeguarding policy? We must make sure everything is in there. And to the point that, you know, we're talking now, part of the FCA's consultation included a requirement that payment and e-money institutions should have wind down plans. Well, having your safeguarding policy, which really shows and demonstrates the rationale for all the various decisions that you've made and your procedures, is the thing that will be turned to by whoever comes in to administer and return funds or organise funds. So that is why it is so important.
Brilliant. Thank you both for answering the questions. I wonder, do we still have Elaine? Ah, we do, to do the final housekeeping.
Hello, yes. Thank you, everybody, especially Colin and Alison, for sharing your words of wisdom, and to Rachel for moderating the panel, and to everyone else then for your attention this afternoon. Look, as I said earlier on, look, any questions, we feel we've covered most of the questions there. If there's any questions we didn't get to, we will follow up individually afterwards. And also just remind you, you will receive the recording as well in the follow-up email. But look, for those who missed any of our earlier webinars, you can now watch all of the recordings on demand on our FSCOM online page on our website. So feel free to access them there, along with all of our other interesting content for the last few months. So look, without further ado, thanks again to all of the panel, Colin, Rachel and Alison. And look, thank you, everyone. Enjoy the rest of your day. Take care and stay safe.
Thank you.